To order. Messages from the House.
January 26, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 34, Liquor Licenses Industry Representatives, ayes 59, noes 0, excused 1. House Bill 135, Recreational Safety Act Amendments, ayes 58, excused 1, conflict 1. House Bill Number 150, Peace Officer Definition, ayes 59, excused 1. January the 26, 2009, from the House of Representatives, Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 12, Brand Inspection Fees, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 2, Street Rod and Custom Vehicles, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. House Bill 8, Certified Public Accountants Revisions, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 29, Tribal Participation in Community Facilities Programs, ayes 59, excused 1. House Bill 165, Adult Adoption, ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, could I have the privilege of the floor, please?
You may.
Mr. President, I intend to ask for a reconsideration on Senate File 11, State Parks Ranger Authority, tomorrow morning. And would like to bring it up at that time.
Mr. President, I left one out.
Okay. All right, without objections, the reconsideration will be tomorrow morning. Messages from the House.
January the 26, 2009, from the House of Representatives, third reading failed. Mr. President, the bill listed below failed to pass the House third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 98, Mandatory Minimum Sentence for Sex Abuse of a Minor. Ayes 20, noes 39, excused 1.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 54, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 72, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. January the 26, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 95, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DiCaria, Ross, Sessions, excuse Senator Perkins, Senator Ross, Chairman. January the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 99, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. January the 26th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number one judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 107, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Finally, Senate File 99, which was just read in, contains an appropriation, and I would respectfully ask that it be re-referred to Committee Number 2.
Without objection, Senate File 99 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation.
Okay.
Considerations of bills in general file, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business. Considerations of bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole. Members, we're going to start back with Senate File 68, continuing the discussion, necessary action on that, and to follow with other bills on general file.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Senator Perkins.
We'll now come to order. We're back on Senate File 68, and we just finished the explanation of the bill. We do have amendments. Would the reading clerk please read the amendment?
Senate File 68, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 19.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate File Amendment Number 1 on Senate File 68, Senate File Number 1. I'll yield the floor to Senator Bebout to explain the amendment.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you all look at your bill, Senate File 68, we had a new statute we created, 41-2-1301. And members of the Senate, that deals with the Platt Decree. And if you look at your legislative report that you all should have received, there's extensive description, discussion about the Pathfinder Modification Project and the, find it here, the Platte River Recovery Implementation Program. And Mr. Chairman, what this narrative does, it explains to you the situation, and I'll try to give you a brief overview of it, and then what the purpose of the Standing Committee Amendment is. And what happened is we had 54,000 acre feet that we could enlarge a Pathfinder reservoir by changing the way the spillway was, and this would offset the silt that had filled up the reservoir. And then there were two ways we could use that water. And the two ways we could use that water was we have an environmental account that was set up in the Platte River Decree that the three governors all signed and that we're operating under. And that environmental count consists of 33,493 acre feet. The second part of that enlargement, the 54,000 acre feet that we can use, goes to what's called the Wyoming water account. And this goes way back to the Deer Creek Dam. Some of you may remember when we talked about that years ago over by the Majority Floor Leader's town of Glen Rock. And that dam was never built, but there was an allocation and discussion of water in there. And out of this, 9,600 acre feet would go into that water Wyoming account, they call it, and it would serve the following purposes in order of priority, and those are listed there. But essentially, the first one, I think the most important, it would be a supplemental water supply for Wyoming's municipalities during times of water rights regulation. Mr. Chairman, what the amendment does, if you look at the amendment and track it through, and it was brought to the Ag Committee by some concerned people just to make sure that when we have the law, and essentially what the amendment and what the existing language in the bill said was it takes the discussion out of the Platte River Decree and tries to put it in statute. And, Mr. Chairman, what the amendment does is really clarifies that. And if you follow me through on the amendment, page 1, line 19, and then page 1, line 23, it inserts in front of that, pursuant to Wyoming Statute 41.3.115. If you look that up, Mr. Chairman, that's the part of our statutes that deals with the way we handle water outside of our state. It says applications for use of water outside the state. So clearly we want the statute to show that when we talk about this decree, we're going to follow that statute. It further goes on to say, when we look at the Wyoming part of it on page 2, line 1, we talk about the municipal water supply. There again, we want to be sure that we understand it's the municipal water supply project in the Nebraska versus Wyoming settlement, which, of course, is a Platt decree. Then if you go to page 20 or line 21 of the amendment, we further put into the bill what I think is good language, and it's just something that protects us more in terms of how this thing may happen. And they're pretty self-explanatory, Mr. Chairman. It says that the authorizations granted under this sections A and B of this section shall terminate if the state of Wyoming withdraws from the Platte River Recovery Implementation Program. Then there's some language given the state engineer that if he determines the transfers authorized under subsections A and B of this section cause any harm to our water users, that the state engineer then shall report the injury to the Select Water Committee. And then it goes on, the last part, Mr. Chairman, is E. It says any revenue generated through the annual temporary water use agreements that we've talked about previously will go to a special water account, Wyoming Statute 412-1001A4. And Mr. Chairman, what that is, that's a miscellaneous account that is in our law that's administered by the Water Development Commission. And every year when that account, they submit a report to the Select Water and let us know what's in an account and then talk about what they might do with that account. And, Mr. Chairman, that's what the first part of the amendment does. I'll be glad to answer any questions, and I think that my colleague from the Mother County is going to talk about the second part of the amendment. So I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Vasey.
Mr. Chairman, the second part of this amendment is inserted on page 25 after line 37. It's Project Riverton Valley Pipeline Relocation. And let me explain why this is a necessary amendment. We've done this before, but every once in a while we'll come where the Highway Department of Transportation will expand their width, or their, in this case, they're putting, I think, two or three more lanes. And there's a water pipeline, an irrigator's pipeline, running right through that. Now, we've done this several other times, but in this case, the timing of the construction and the timing to make sure that water gets to the irrigators is necessary for an amendment. These amendments don't come very often, but in this case, it was a matter of timing. So unless we get and this project, if you're familiar, as you leave Riverton going north past the Honor Farm and out that way, it's, I believe, four-lane. And then as it turns and starts towards Boyson and the center of the universe, Shoshone, that they're going to expand that to four lanes, and there's this irrigation pipeline right in this. So that's why that needs to be moved. So that's the reason for the amendment, how this amendment is handled. And we've done this in other instances. The total cost is $1,300,000. The highway department picks up over half of that. They take the responsibility of that. So then that leaves half to be done, but with the water development, there'll be a grant to the that irrigation district for $525,000, and then there'll also be a project land a loan to be repaid of $75,000 at 12.5% for 4% interest. That brings the appropriation to $600,000. The special conditions is the sponsor is responsible for all project costs by the exception of the purchase of project materials as supported by the vendor invoices and approved by the commission. And the sponsor is also responsible for retaining professional engineering services to design the project. So it's a matter of urgency. We don't bring these amendments regularly, but in this case, it's one that needs to be done. The reason that there's a certain amount of grant, I believe that's those irrigators. There's not a lot of them, I don't believe, but a lot of they're also servicing another debt, and that's about 50 cents per acre feet. So that's where the $75,000 comes up. So I'd be glad to stand for questions if you have any.
Thanks, Senator Vasey. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, on the Riverton project, why is, if the highway department's causing this by where they're going to build a road, why is the highway funds paying for all of it? That's what they would routinely do, I think, when they destroy a private irrigation ditch or something like that when they build a road.
Senator Vasey?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how long ago this was, and maybe the good senator from Natrona County remembers this, but there was a head of the highway department and a head of the water development commission that decided a good deal would be to run these pipelines along there, and we've been caught in a couple, I think one around Worland and one around another case, and this is just one. And, I mean, you have to look at it as probably those deals were made years and years and years ago, and they can't be redone, so this is the way it is. The highway department, and it's an expansion, maybe 50 or 100 years ago, they didn't think there was going to be a four-lane highway necessarily there, but it is now. So.
Thank you, Senator Vasey. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to further try to clarify, there was an agreement signed in the 80s between the then head of the YDOT, Lino Mangini, I believe is who it was, and the head of the irrigation district, and they contemplated moving this. There was a lot of reasons to do it. The irrigation had stepped up. It had taken a big, substantial loan to do it. It was going to conserve water, and they decided they couldn't get the right-of-way to the because of the private property to the north of the highway, so they decided to put it in the right-of-way. And if you read the agreement, you can see that they anticipated a road that would be built, but no one thought it would be five lanes. And so they planned on the growth in the future, but they didn't plan on that. And the riser that you have to have in a closed pipe for irrigation are in the shoulders, and they pose a safety risk. So it has to be moved. And YDOT, there's somewhere in statutes that say they're obligated to pay half, a minimum of half of any time they have to move any kind of a sewer water line owned by an entity of the state, a city, or whatever. And they've stepped up to do it, but yet they think that the irrigation district, as they should have some skin in the game, and that's how we came up with this way of doing it.
Thanks, Senator Bebout. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the question that I have, I hope, has to do with the amendment, and if it's not, if it's out of order, then I will offer it at another time. But the question that I brought was prompted in my mind by the good senator from Fremont County as he discussed the raising of the Pathfinder Reservoir in lieu of the construction of the Deer Creek Dam. And in order to fill that level, that Pathfinder Reservoir up to that newer level, it prompted a lot of concern on the part of those lower Platte River irrigators in regard to whether or not water might be taken out of their appropriation in order to fill that Pathfinder to that new level. The question that I have is, does somehow this amendment help to alleviate that, or is my question out of place?
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, the majority floor leader's questions are never out of place. and it is pertinent. And what you have to understand, of course, is there was some concern by those irrigators in the Saratoga area, and my colleague from Mother County could speak to it too, and also some irrigators further north in the Muddy Gap area and over in the Jeffrey City area. And because they were concerned, and of course we're not going to raise the dam in such, we're just going to deal with the spillway. They'll give us the extra 54,000 acre feet. What where we are today now is Water Development Commission has negotiated with those two groups to settle this, and part of the settlement agreement requires they go to the Board of Control. As was presented in our committee the other night, that the Board of Control has signed off on it. It's coming forward, and it takes a 30-day comment period, but the agreement reached between the Board of Control, Wyoming Water Development Commission, the state engineer, and those irrigators will be fulfilled. So as I understand it, everything should be okay. And this language that is in the amendment only makes it better and tries to protect irrigators more.
Thank you. Let's go to Senator Vasey, and then we'll go to Senator.
Part of that is a balancing. I don't know how much new water is. It's an account that Pathfinder sealed it in over the years, and so we're coming back to the regular thing. And it has been said several times, this is part of that decree, and like it or not, this is where it is. So,
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, And further on that, on the Pathfinder issue, a number of my constituents who irrigate out of the Casper-Alcova Irrigation District are concerned. They see Pathfinder's priority is 1904. Theirs is 1934. And they're concerned as a practical matter that additional storage in Pathfinder from modifying the spillway at 54,000 acre feet will be water which would otherwise accrue to the Casper-Alcova Irrigation District. And so they're concerned about that. And have they been part of these negotiations, or are they just out in the cold on this one?
Thank you, Senator Scott.
Well,
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, they've all been at the table on this, Senator Scott. The only time this decree will kick in is from March to May 1st. That's before most irrigators, except those on Bates Creek irrigate. Bates Creek, they start irrigating in January and February. But the rest of them, usually you don't really get the snow off and grass start growing until about the 1st of May. So, and there's never been a call on that river yet.
Go to Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing, too, as it was explained to me, the chairman of the Ackerman is exactly right, that it's that period of time is when they make up the volume is from January to May, or January to May, but also that the three irrigation districts are all treated separately. So one doesn't rely on the other in terms of how the water is appropriated. But we can get a better answer for you if that doesn't satisfy.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Scott.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't satisfy, because this is not having to do with when you irrigate. This has to do with storage in particularly Seminole, which is under a junior priority to Pathfinder. And so that if there's more water stored in Pathfinder under the 1904 priority, there will be less water available to store in Seminole for Casper-Alcova under the 1930, I think it's 34 priority. And so they're afraid that this will damage their ability to store water, because the system rarely fills. When the system fills, it'll be fine. But that's a rare occurrence, and they've just had a very close call on running all the way out of water for that irrigation project, because they're junior priority. So their thinking is that if more is stored for the senior priority, there'd be less for the junior priority, and it's not a timing factor. It's a matter of the total amount of water available for storage, and I wonder what protection there is for them.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, the only other thing I would add is that per the Platt decree, we are obligated in that environmental account to come up with water. And as we looked at the issue and tried to determine a way to do it, it became apparent that a logical solution was to look at the Pathfinder. Now, how that affects those in terms of water priorities, I'm not sure that it would be any different if we didn't have that, because they are a 1934 right compared to a 1904 right, 1904. But, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to get some further explanation for you.
Further discussion. We're on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee number 1 has passed. We have another amendment, I believe.
Yes. Committee of the Whole.
Okay, Senator Bebout. Excuse me, go ahead and please read in the amendment.
Senate File 68, Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 2.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 68. Members of the Senate, this amendment once again gets into the amendment, previous amendment. It talks about trying to be sure that we cover all aspects of the Platte River Decree, and we have proper reporting to this legislative body about what might be going on. This particular amendment deals with the director of the Wyoming Water Development Commission. And if he determined that the Wyoming water users are not receiving the regulatory certainty and he shall report to the Select Water Committee. Once again, Mr. Chairman, just more protection for our water and the irrigators in Wyoming.
Thank you. For the discussion, are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Vibout's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 68, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Discussion on the bill. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion with the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 68, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, Committee of the Amendment, Senate File 68 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill we have is Senate File 124. Will you please read in the bill?
Senate File 124, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, Education Reserve Funding, an act relating to public funds. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do pass recommendation for Senate File 124. Ladies and gentlemen, we talked about this a little bit the other day. This is the sweep bill. There are two, what we describe as sweeps in this bill. It takes language that's presently in the budget, modifies it, and puts it in the statute. The first sweep is over on page 3. And what happens here is that in each fiscal year, the school foundation program account is swept down to $100 million. So if you look over at your goldenrod, and you would see in the school foundation program account, there's $100 million. What this does is it makes sure that every year that we go into a new fiscal year, there's at least $100 million in the school foundation program account. However, recognizing that there's a revenue flow that comes from federal mineral royalties that in the past few years has been in excess of what's necessary to fund schools, it takes sweeps all of the dollars above and beyond the $100 million out of the account. Now, those are the excess dollars that we use to, the equivalent of the dollars that we use to fund the Hathaway program and some other great programs. And presently, the budget provides that now that the Hathaway is fully funded, once that sweep takes place, anything above the $100 million is then swept in the Common School Permanent Land Fund in the effort to try to build up that corpus. Recognizing that we're going to be having we may have some fiscal problems coming up with funding the school capital construction, what we do now is instead of following the budget outline, we will sweep those dollars out of the foundation account and put them into the school capital construction account. That's a modification from what's happening. Then over on page 1 to 2, what we'll be doing once the monies sweep into the common school into the school capital construction account, at the end of the biennium, we'll make sure that there's at least 50% of the amount required to fund the then current capital construction requirements. Anything above that would sweep into the common school permanent land fund. So that what we're really talking about is any excess revenue that's generated into the school foundation program account on account of the earmarking of federal mineral royalties, we'll first make sure that we have enough money to fund the schools going forward. We'll sweep the dollars into the school capital construction account. Then we'll make sure that there's enough money start going forward in the school capital construction account. If there is, then there would be a sweep of the excess dollars into the Common School Permanent Land Fund, which would be a savings component, building that corpus. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, just one question. If we leave it the way it is, and that money goes into the permanent school land income fund, we can still go in there later and grab it, or once it goes in there, I didn't think it became inviolate. So we could, the way it is, still do what we're doing without having it set up to earmark it going this way, correct?
Senator Nicholas?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, the way it is a little bit confusing because the way it presently is under the budget, we've only been living under it for 2 years. Had it not been for that budget amendment, the foundation program account balance would have swelled when we had if we had not funded Hathaway, we'd have a balance in the school foundation program account well in excess of $500 or $600 million. Under the budget, which is only effective for 2 years right now, there will be a sweep in from the this account from the school foundation program account. Anything above $100 million will get swept into the Common School Permanent Land Fund, into the corpus. But that's only good so long as the budget, and it's also then comes up for review every time the budget comes up. So the idea here is to codify it, put in the statute, but then create one more sweeping effect just to have protection. Now, having said this, if there is any concern about whether or not we should not be sweeping into the corpus, the sweep into the corpus of the permanent or the Common School Permanent Land Fund, which is permanent once it goes in the corpus, that does not happen until the end of the biennium. So, for example, this year we would be back next year and able to review it, and if we didn't like it, we just intercept the money and direct that not take place. So this only takes place if we have adequate resources, we don't interfere with the fund flow. And right now we are interfering with the fund flow over statute because the budget provides something different than what the statute says. I hope that explains it.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I have long felt that the school capital construction system that we now have was at risk of giving a situation where we were building ultra-expensive school buildings, and too many of them, at the expense of the programs that were conducted in those schools. In other words, that we were had a bias in favor of capital construction and we're going to hurt the school operating. Now, that has not happened to date because we've had good sources of funding for the school capital construction. But this looks to me like the first step down the road toward that actually happening if money gets tight in the future and we are unable to fund, say, the external cost adjustment to keep up with inflation because we're spending too much money on school capital construction. I'm thinking that this is the first step in that direction and thinking maybe I ought to vote against the bill for that reason. And I guess my question is that what's going on? Is this the first step in that direction? And what kind of risks are we running?
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reply to that, I don't think so. And in fact, our biggest liability going forward is in the school capital construction because we don't have any really permanent source of income going into there. We have permanent needs year in and year out that are growing, yet we have no permanent fund. We've just been living on one-time coal bonus money. What this does is any money that's going into the school foundation account for the general services and operations of the schools, we'll have an opportunity to access that money when we come down here and spend the funds that are needed for school operations. All this bill does is say any money that's above the $100 million balance level, say it's $200 million, that extra $100 million above it will be fed into the school foundation school construction account rather than going into the permanent land fund. So what this is it offers us a hedge in case we come down here sometime and we don't have sufficient funds in the school capital construction account. This is one way of protecting against that day, which could be fairly soon. Anyone who takes a look at the LSO projections into the next biennium will see that we're, you know, coming really close in a lot of the accounts. But the one account right now that are projecting a major deficit of roughly $250 million is in school capital construction. So this bill allows us to spend on schools whatever we need. But if we have some extra, it automatically goes into the school capital construction account as a savings and allows us to build up that school capital construction account to a certain level before there's that sweep into the permanent school fund. So I think this is a hedge against someday when we're going to run into a deficit there.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I explain it. If you take a look, pull out your goldenrod and take a look at the school foundation program account, which is at page 4. And if you look at the foundation program account, you see that it sweeps down to $100 million, which is the fund balance at the end. Now, the reason why it's $100 million is you drop up, you look up at two lines. Because of the enormity of federal mineral royalties coming in, we had some funds that were available to us. You see that we've got $251 million going into the school capital construction account. So that $251 million flows down, and you can see it as an entry into the revenue on the school capital construction account. Now, the school capital construction account has a balance of zero. The reason it has a balance of zero is because we only put enough money from the school foundation program account into the school capital construction account to pay for present construction. Now, if the budget bill stands as it is today, right above that, you see that there is a transfer of $245 million into the Common School Permanent Land Fund. Now, the concern is that perhaps we shouldn't be so hasty in putting that directly into the Common School Permanent Land Fund until we know that we can meet our obligations for building schools. And yet we have these excess dollars. It would be nice to build up the permanent savings. So the way, if we pass this bill today, what would change is presently we're building about $400 million worth of schools a year because that's about the construction capacity for school capital construction. So we have a $400 million budget to build schools. That $245 million, $200 million would flow down into the school capital construction account. That's one half of the $400 million. So the balance below would go from zero to, actually what would happen is the entire $245 would flow into the school capital construction account. Then the balance at the end of the fiscal year, or the biennium, would be one half of what it cost us to build schools this year. So if our present budget was $400 million, we would leave $200 million in the school capital construction account. Under that scenario, if we put the $245 down below, $45 million would flow into the corpus of the Common School Permanent Land Fund. So what we're saying is let's do one more, let's harbor the money, if you will, hold it for the next construction season. How much do you put in there? The proposal was that we put in one half of the present budget, and presently, I mean, if things go out the way they are going now, the other half will more than likely be paid for by way of COLEs bonuses. Having said all that, if we go into the budget process and we find out that there's not enough money, we come back next year, we do the budget before the end of before this sweep happens. If we're doing our budget next year and we need the entire 245, we just put in the budget provision, it says notwithstanding the statute, there will be no transfer to the common school permanent land fund. But the policy we're setting up here is that if we run into that, those circumstances that we saw when we were able to fund the Hathaway program out of the common school or out of the school foundation program account, the policy is let's start putting some of that money into savings, into the corpus of the common school permanent land fund after we meet our school capital construction responsibilities. And I think that based upon what we can see as to the forecast for COLE's bonuses, that if we put in one half of our present capital construction count or budget, there will always be enough to fund schools. And if there's not, then we will change it in the budget as we've done in the past.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, the only thing I really question in all that explanation is the description of the school capital construction budget as things we need. They're things that are wanted. They're not needs. I would suggest to the Senate that if we reverted to the old constitutional system in one form or another, where the local districts had some of their taxpayers' mill levy, a skin in the game, that the needs would be a lot smaller than they are right now. If we really get in trouble financially in the future, that's where we're going to have to think about going. And it'd take a while to get there because given the Supreme Court decisions, you'd probably have to amend the Constitution. But I continue to be concerned that the way that decision has worked and the way we've handled it, we're sooner or later going to wind up robbing the school operating. Now, we haven't done that today. We're fine. If anything, the schools are, they're extraordinarily well funded. But I continue to be worrying about the future, that we're going to do school capital construction at the expense of the operating, and I'm a little nervous that this bill is the first step in that direction.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a kind of a similar concern, but not. The greatest pressure, as was mentioned by the senator from Natrona County, in the expanding cost of schools, it's been my experience over these many years, comes from the local districts. They want the best that their architect can convince them that they can buy. Are we encouraging that by putting more money into the school capital construction account where everybody can look at it and say, gee, you got lots of money, why can't we have the extra auditorium, or why can't we have the plush theaters and all of those kinds of things? So I just want to be sure we're not encouraging them to do that, because that's where most of the pressure comes from, on all of these kind of things that, again, are maybe nice to have, but not necessarily necessary. And so I have a little bit of concern that the more money we put in there, the more money they're going to come after. Hence, we could reach a point where we're spending it all on capital construction and maybe don't have enough to really meet the education things. I'm not saying that'll happen, but I think the more money we put into there, the more there is to go after.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The way that the statutes and the budget is worded right now, the choice is the money can go into the permanent school land fund, or it can go into the school with the way it is presently. That money gets swept into the permanent land fund, or with this bill, it can get moved down into the school foundation account. So those are really the two choices right now. We've always left, and for the last several years, we've always left here with the school foundation account at $100 million. So that's what's at stake at this bill, with this bill. Where do you want money above $100 million gone to? Do you want to go to a permanent fund where you can't draw it out, or do you want it to go into capital construction? If folks want to do different formulas, you can certainly go into this bill with a couple of amendments. You might want to leave $200 million in the school foundation account. or you might want to leave more into the school CapCon account before it's swept in. With regard to the concerns about how we do CapCon, it really goes beyond the scope of this bill. We have existing laws in place that we've all agreed to. It's passed. The Supreme Court has blessed them and said, you know, this meets constitutional muster. And we finally got out of the Supreme Court after 12 years. The fine senator from Cody and I, as well as some other folks here on the floor, have served on the School Capital Construction Committee for many, many years right now. And we hear from school districts about how tight the School Facilities Commission is and how they would like to expand the schools beyond what there's being permitted there. So we certainly hear it from both sides. But we have reviewed the standards. We've reviewed the way that they do it. We don't think that there's a lot of frivolous spending right now. And based upon the Constitution, they need to bring us an amount saying, constitutionally, this is what you need to have in order to fund the schools. So we're simply trying to structure this account to reflect the reality of the statutes, not to drive policy. Driving policy means going back into the present statutes and changing those. And then if you change those policies, then we can restructure the way that we put these accounts together.
Thank you. We'll go. Senator Townsend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like to keep things simple. I like the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid. But in this, I think the word that we really have to understand and comprehend in this bill is that the permanent land fund is just what that is. It's permanent. So if we do put that in there, just let it flow like it's supposed to. If this fills up, it runs into this, and if it fills up, it runs into that. What we've done, we put another tank in here to catch a little bit more water before it goes into the permanent. If we don't look ahead enough to see that the accounts are funded, then it automatically goes to the permanent fund, and we can't get it back out. We can't get the interest out. What we're trying to do is anticipate lowered revenues in the future. If we find that we have saved too much, we can simply, and it will automatically, go to the permanent land fund. So the important part is, if you put in the permanent land fund, all you ever get back out of that is the interest. But if we anticipate the funding needs and we don't have enough coming in, this is a way that we can ensure that we get done what we want to do in the financing of the capital construction.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, and I share the concerns that every time you create a pool of money out there, it's an invitation for people to spend. And that's true if you're talking about the rainy day account, the LSRA, or any other account that we have. But the difficulty here is we are balancing between making sure that we don't have to tax our general fund to pay for a school foundation program account. And we've been lucky over the last four or five years that we've been able to use excess school foundation program funds to pay for the Hathaway program. And this year, $250 million is being available for school capital construction. But no matter how you look at it, that $245 million that says sweep into the Common School Permanent Land Fund is sitting there like a big red sore thumb. And it's time to decide, what are we going to do with that? Chairman of the Education Committee proposed one time that we would reduce the earmarks into the Common School Permanent Land, or excuse me, into the School Foundation Program account. Was not widely supported by the education community. We do have an undersized permanent fund in the Common School Permanent Land Fund, so this is an opportunity as we look forward to begin developing and building those accounts. But I don't know any way to hide from the goldenrod the fact that there is money, and there's excess money. It's there. So what we're doing now is setting a policy. And the policy says we're going to have $100 million to go forward in the school foundation program account. Revenues should be sufficient to pick up any other obligation necessary to fund schools. We're going to make sure that we have at least half of what's necessary to build to do the school capital construction budget going forward before we do the sweep. Now, I said $400 million. If you look at it, the school CapCon amount is $337 million. It was going to be $400 million. We didn't have the resources to do it, so we lowered it from down to the 337. There's no proposal presently to restore those dollars in light of our present budget issues. But if we see lower monies to the school foundation program account, it would be prudent to have a buffer in the school capital construction account. What is the amount that ought to be in the school capital construction account? The testimony from the Facilities Commission staff was, if you look at the total amount of assets you have out there, add up the total assets of all the schools, about $400 million is about what it's going to take every 2 years to maintain and replace that volume assets. You have billions of dollars of assets out there, and they have to be maintained. Some of them are going to have to be replaced, and there's going to be growing schools. And right now, the notion is that we put a huge amount of money, and now we're going to see a stabilization. And if we stabilize our investment, then we ought to be able to have a pretty constant appropriation for maintaining and building new facilities. If you stop spending money, then 10 years later, you're going to have a huge backlog that you're going to have to pay for. So what we're trying to do is regularize our investment in the schools, and at the same time take advantage of some of the surpluses that may accrue and put them into the Common School Permanent Land Fund should they appear. I urge your support for the bill.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 124, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 124 is passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I have privilege of the floor?
Senator Massey, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wanted to introduce a group of folks. I think some of them just left. I don't know if there's still any of them up in the gallery or not.
Senator Massey, I think they got tired and left, but there's still a few up here, I think.
Okay, a few stragglers. They're from the University of Wyoming Accelerated Nursing Program, our future nursing professionals here in the state of Wyoming that came by to listen to a good debate. If they would stand in the gallery, and if we could welcome them, that would be wonderful.
Thank you. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 125. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File Number 125, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, State Employees Compensation, and Act Relating to the Administration of Government. It was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation for Senate File Number 125. Ladies and gentlemen, the new director of A&I, when he took office earlier this year, engaged in the process of going through and evaluating the entire employee compensation program. The state hired a consultant who went to look at all of our compensation statutes, and this statute is a result of a portion of that work. Among other things, the study engaged in an exercise where every state employee was required to look at his job description, evaluate it against what he was doing, and the part of the process was beginning to evaluate whether or not the compensation plan system was appropriately developed. This policy essentially articulates the work of that product. It would consist of a variety of people from the state agencies, the governor's office, and JAC members that went through the process. The idea is now is to make sure and to articulate a compensation policy where people are with greater flexibility to pay people that based upon the relevant labor markets. We will begin to take into cost comparator other sectors besides simply government employees, begin to look at non-governmental employees. If this program had been fully funded this year, it would have taken about another $6.9 million to bring employees that are identified below their pay grade or what they should have been paid based upon the market. We don't have those resources, and we're not appropriating it. What it demonstrates is that, notwithstanding we have this policy, we still control the budget, and we control the resources. But part of what's going to happen is the Division of Administration and Information begin to implement pay raises. They will now begin to look at the labor markets, be more competitive. What we found is the greatest number of turnovers were in some key positions, engineers, for example, in some of the areas where they were not meeting their being paid their counterparts in the private sector, and that is and continues to be a real drain on some of those folks. So this essentially puts into a statute that says this is how we think people ought to be compensated when you work for the state. The other things it does, turning over on page 8, you'll recall that we put $10 longevity pay into the budget each year. This codifies the longevity pay, puts it into statute. We've been doing it for many years now. Also in the budget, there are two provisions for moving expenses that are in the budget. This codifies those provisions. One is allows the governor to spend up to $20,000 for relocating employees down to Cheyenne, and then when there is a change in the governorship, there is a transitional staff money in the budget. So with respect to the appropriation on the fiscal note, all of the entire fiscal note is already budgeted or profiled in our budget. This simply codifies what we're presently doing. I urge your support of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize because this went up rather quickly, but could you tell me what Section 2, what those repealers are?
Mr. Chairman, I can't right now, but I will in a moment. Well, I should know them. Do you remember which they were?
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, page 5, line 15, it says there, it's crossing out, including requirements to possess professional licenses. I have a question concerning that. I know that several job descriptions, in fact, there are a lot of them, and I'll give you two areas. One is healthcare. And the other is DEQ particularly. There are parts of those upon federal requirements that those people have to possess professional licensing. And I have a constituent who we have been, and Senator Vasey helped me once, and several, I've been taken through this whole process several times, I might add. But what he is saying, and I'll give you an example on his particular instance, and then I will talk about the healthcare professionals. In DEQ on a lot of permitting, the feds require the professional licensing certification. They require it for that permit to go forward. What is happening in DEQ, according to my constituent, and I believe him because I've looked at it too, is that they have opened up many of those jobs without the professional licensing requirement, so that it gets up to one, it gets up to the head of whichever one does it. One person will have a professional licensing requirement. Those other engineers below will not have the standing to have any input, and they and I will say this in their defense, they say this is not so, but they have it if they are they don't if they are not recognized of having the professional licensing requirement, they will not have the standing to question anything or bring any additional information forward that can be considered valid in the issuing of that license. Additionally, in the healthcare, and we had this in management audit on the certification that has to be given to our healthcare facilities by the state in order for them to receive Medicaid or Medicare money. Those engineers or those individuals they send out there to certify those healthcare facilities have to have professional licensing in many areas. So my question is, why are you taking this out? Is it just to make middle management easy? Is it just make it easier for them? Or what? Why are we taking it out?
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. And looking at this also addresses, for the most part, those repealers. But if you look over at page 5, at the first paragraph, line 3, the current job description shall describe job content, work performance, responsibilities, requirements to possess professional licenses, et cetera. So all we've done is cleaned up the statutes and concluded you don't need to have the requirements. So we are going to take into account professional licensing, things like that. So part of this was just cleaning up the statutes to make sure that it's not in saying the same thing twice.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the good senator from Cheyenne, if you top of that page, little I, that describes basically, it still has the current job descriptions, the job content, including the nature and level of work, performed responsibilities, requirements, and possesses professional licenses, certifications, and registrations. The key word there that I think we need to refer to is that this is a minimum. I'm trying to find the line here, Mr. Chairman. 13. At a minimum, these factors shall include knowledge and experience. And so this is describing just the minimum. And certainly a minimum would not require the professional licenses and certifications. So.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I guess based upon reams of information that I've received over several years is that why put it in if you need that person, and I'll take the healthcare certification as an example. There were no qualified people in the state of Wyoming that held the licensing to certify some of those healthcare centers. The drug and alcohol centers and things that the state of Wyoming has. So what was happening is they were having to contract from out-of-state people that do this. And I understand, and part of the reason for the requirement in management audit to look at this at this division is they were so backed up because we do not have the professional licensing in this state. Hence, we hired at a minimum. We did not say to them that we'll hire you, we need you for this job, you will be required to get professional licensing. I know now that they have taken steps to remedy that, to put professional licensing people that hold those licenses in the state of Wyoming in order to speed up that process so that those centers can be certified to accept some of the money they're supposed to accept. So I still have a real concern, even at a minimum level. If you know that person you don't want to hire minimum level of people for jobs that require professional licensing unless we come up with some kind of wording that says if the job requires professional licensing, you're going to have to get it if you're going to be hired for these jobs. Or we're going to be left like we have been in the healthcare field. And according to my very vocal constituent, who continually argues with DEQ, I might add, is the recognition of people wish to get those professional licensing and geology and in engineering, why we don't recognize that as part of the pay, as the valuation in the pay scale. And I don't know. I just wonder about this since we had this whole thing, us particularly with the healthcare facilities. And I understand now we are almost down to one person in DEQ who can rubber stamp permits because the hiring has been at a lower level with no professional licensing. And these people have been before the boards of professional licensing asking for their support in this area in geology and in engineering.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the whole purpose of the compensation plan program is to identify your job characteristics. And if, in fact, you need a law degree to perform your job, and that's a requirement, then go out and find out what is the market pay for a lawyer, or if it's an engineer, for the engineer. That's the purpose we're having this discussion and these changes. One of the areas, for example, that we saw that were undercompensated was nurses. We put a bunch more money in for the nursing. When we went out and did the job analysis, where we began to compare and bring in other markets, other data, we found that, in fact, the nurses were underpaid. We're approaching, we're getting better to where it is more appropriate. Having said that, if you happen to be a lawyer performing a job that doesn't have the requirement of lawyer in the job description, you don't get compensated for that extra provision. So the first and foremost is having an accurate job description. And where we might used to have four or five pay bands with general descriptions, we're going to have a much larger number of descriptions now. And you will look and you'll be able to evaluate exactly what are the skills you're being hired to provide. And then making sure that you're being fairly compensated for all those skills, which should address the concerns that my colleague has. And in the DEQ, we've identified areas where there were shortfalls or undercompensation, and we will begin to address that. This also begins to address the issue that if you put more money in, where do you put money in? You're going to see some employees get redlined. And there are some people that, notwithstanding that you give 4% every year, they've hit the top. They've redlined out. And the monies may go to other people. But you can't continue to, if the market justifies a $30,000 salary, and you're putting more salary money in, you don't go to the person that's already at $32,000 and give them more compensation so that you create their disparity. So the disparity happens on both ends. So part of what we're going to do is we're going to make sure we have better descriptions of job descriptions and then have a better ability, a more suitable mechanism of evaluating job salaries for all the classifications and using greater sources of input throughout the state to make sure that the employees that we do hire are being fairly compensated.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Senator Plater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you started out by saying this is really putting in statute what they do now, because there is rules and regulations. And a constituent of mine had this about a year ago, a problem with it, that said they would be brought to market rate at 2 years, half a market rate actually at 1 year and 100% of market rate at 2 years. So this addresses market rates. So in reality, are we starting out new hires at a market rate if their job description matches the local market and this is what you'll start with? So anybody that was hired prior to that, are they all then being brought up to market rate? Which sounds like a large raise for many people. And also, if it's just for new hires, then I know in the rules and regulations, they were not to interrupt or upset the apple cart by bringing somebody in at a higher rate than somebody with experience just because a new rule came in that said you start per your job description, the market rate is here, although you were hired a year ago and you were hired in it here. So is everybody being brought up to a market rate per their job description? And are we getting rid of the rule and regulation that had a 50% market rate at 1 year, and 2 years you'd be at market rate? So I hope you understood my questions, and I think this addresses it. But as the good senator from KC said, we just got this to us, and so I haven't had a chance to really analyze it.
Thank you. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With respect to the compensation philosophy, a new philosophy has been implemented. When I said that we're codifying things that we're already doing, that refers to the longevity pay and to the last provisions on pages 8 and 9 of the bill. But we are seeing a new philosophy to try to make sure that we identify what your salary level should be based upon a better assessment of the market. And presently, the market assessments that were being done did not have any comparators for the private marketplace in Wyoming. So you might have found that you're getting your salaries for engineers compared to engineers working for CDOT or one of the other firms, and yet what we see is a lot of our skilled engineers going off into the oil and gas community. So it's a better assessment with respect to we brought in more sources of data to really identify what are the real market salaries. So that once you're identified, then that's where you ought to be paid at that salary grade. And having said that, what we do know is that to fully implement this program, this new philosophy, to bring everybody up to their market level was about $6.9 million. The governor recommended that dollars in light of the revenue shortfalls. Those dollars were taken out of the budget. I don't expect the JAC to recommend that they go back in. And so the department is now looking to agencies to begin to look at making the adjustments with their own budgets so they can use their vacancy dollars. They can do it by attrition, moving dollars over. They have a variety of skills resources to come up with money to get people at market. And if you're over the market, then at some point, and I'm not sure this has been fully implemented, but there will be redlining till the market catches up to your grade.
Thank you. Are we ready for the question? Halls and Senator Sessions.
I'm going to ask a rhetorical question based upon our fine appropriation chair's last comments. Is we've been through this several times on compensation pay plans, and I just want to ask the rhetorical question, what is the point if we're not going to put the money in it to do the job? I don't understand that.
Senator Nicholas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have put the money. We put almost $9 million into market adjustments last year. I've got a list of employees. When I began serving on JAC on the House side, there were no employees paid over $100,000. The list now goes on several pages of employees that are well over $100,000. Believe me, folks, the state has done a much better job at making sure state employees get paid well. Part of addressing this, you also have to look at their benefits, the 11.5% of retirement that we pay. We have a phenomenal health insurance program. But if you begin to look at it, you will see that there's been dramatic salaries increases for state employees. Now, we have identified other employees that based upon the new market data, deserve more income, if you will, to get them to their markets. Some agencies have great ability to make up these. The Department of Health, for example, they have a huge budget. They have a huge 100 series for of salaries. They can be looked, they can look at using their internal dollars to get here. And we plan to do that and work towards it, and then as money becomes available, if we'll address it. But at all times, our budget is always exactly that. It's a budget, and we live within our means.
Thank you. Senator Honeycutt, there you are.
Mr. Chairman and Senator from Natrona County, I have a question on page 4, line 20. It talks about non-cash rewards and recognition programs, and just kind of curious of what that means, and would that cause any disparity between agencies that would cause some strife?
I apologize.
Senator Honeycutt, can you speak into your mic, please? That would help.
Okay, page 4, line 20, it talks about non-cash rewards and recognition programs. Just kind of curious what those would be, and would something like that start causing some disparity between agencies that would cause some problems with state employees?
Mr. Chairman, these are our simple things. These are like your five-year watch, your diplomas, things that are certificates. We are codifying practices that, in fact, help employee morale and provide the authority for agencies to continue that practices. They're not big items, but they do make a difference in the workforce and the morale. But they're simple things. We're talking about a five-year pin, a 10-year pin, things like that.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with the favorable recommendation of Senate File 125, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 125 is passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, the JAC returns to the process of marking up the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. So we're going to excuse our JAC members, I guess. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. Will the reading clerk please read in the bill?
Senate File Number 31, sponsored by Senator Hines, Brucellosis Surveillance Program 2, an act relating to agriculture and animals. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Geis, Johnson, Vasey, and Jennings. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis.
When the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move Senate File 31 do pass, and I'll yield the floor to the President of the Senate.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, first there's an amendment to this bill that I think it will work better if I explain it all together, and so I would move the amendment and ask that it be read in.
Senate File 31, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Mr. Chairman, what this bill is about is a small effort to help those people in the area where we've had problems with brucellosis the last few years. This bill virtually came from some of the members, of which I am one, of the Governor Task Force on Brucellosis. And what the bill does is expand what we're currently doing. We're currently helping out with some of the spaying, I mean, with some of the vaccination. We're paying a fee to the veterinarians who vaccinate in this region for the livestock owners that have having their animals vaccinated. This bill would expand that program to include spaying and vaccinating adult cattle as well as heifers. Currently, we only vaccinate heifers. It's also expanded where it's only limited to this designated surveillance area, which the Livestock Board have the authority to set. And we do it, it's right in there on the page one, to the extent that may reasonably be necessary to maintain the brucellosis-free status of the state of Wyoming. While the amendment is a full page, it virtually just putting those words in several places that are needed, where we added spaying heifers and adult vaccination. It's a small way to help compensate in this area. The people have to have a licensed veterinarian or else have a staff at a sale barn do the vaccinating or the work. And there's a limit on what we pay. As you'll see, that hasn't changed. It's currently from $3.50 to $8 per head. Last year in our budget, we included funds in this. My understanding is that there's still funds in that account. There would be no need for any additional funds. This has pretty much explained the bill. But if there's questions, I'll stand ready to answer any questions. If not, I ask for your support.
Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, a question. The way this is structured, the compensation goes if a veterinarian performs the spaying. Actually, in Wyoming, to spay something, you don't have to use a veterinarian. If you get someone who makes, and there are people who, to a great extent, make their living doing nothing but spaying heifers, can you still use them under this and have the state pay? Or if they use a private contractor, how does that wash out?
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, under the current law, I believe it's stated right there that they only pay accredited veterinarians who perform the service or to livestock auction markets that use their facilities and veterinarians to conduct the testing and the work. So currently, the way the law is, and this doesn't change it, it would need to be a license veterinarian.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, if we change that to a contractor, does it in any way jeopardize our brucellosis status with the federal government? And I'm looking for the reference to it. In other words, if we amended this bill to allow a private contractor, a non-veterinarian, to perform the spaying, then does it jeopardize our standing with the federal government in terms of compliance with that area of the state that is under the close scrutiny of the APHIS people?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question for sure right now, but
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, question on the Standing Committee Amendment. As I read it, the program is then limited to designated surveillance areas as defined by the Livestock Board. And I presume those would be in the areas, particularly around Yellowstone and Teton, and adjoining areas where we've had some brucellosis problems in those counties. Am I correct in that reading? And the reason I ask in part is I don't think I have any conflict of interest on this because I don't ranch in those areas, but I want to find out.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, the areas we're talking about are Park, Hot Springs, Fremont, Sublette, Lincoln, Teton counties are the main areas where this will take place. And that's where we do find brucelloses in the elk and the bison, and they commingle with the livestock. And so we're trying to head off keeping us a free status so the rest of the state do not have to test everything before they can sell them.
Thanks, Senator Geis. Are we ready for the question on the standing committee amendment? All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion on standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 31, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. All right, standing committee amendment number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, in the bill it says $3.50 to $8. What does it really cost to spay a heifer?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't done it for several years, and so I haven't got a bill. So I can't tell you, but that I can check with a vet and find out what they're charging. I'm sure it have gone up like everything else.
Senator Hines is going to phone a friend. So, okay. Are we ready? We're on the bill for the discussion. Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Geis' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 31, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 31 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 47. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 47, sponsored by the Education Committee, Hathaway Student Scholarship Program Administration, and act relating to the Hathaway Student Scholarship Program. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Cole, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Flatren, Senator Cole, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the do pass recommendation on Senate File 47, Hathaway Student Scholarship Program Administration. This bill is brought to you by the Joint Education Committee. And has four separate sections to it. The first section, Section 1, deals specifically with the 2008 Session Laws, Chapter 95, Section 1001, Sign Language as a Second Language for the Hathaway Scholarship Program, I believe being the amendment of the good senator from KC. Section 2 appropriates money to the Department of Education to establish a transcript data center for Common Core coding. Section 3 appropriates money to the Department of Education to go into the 8th grade through counselors and start putting in place counseling for the benefit of 8th graders as they enter 9th grade to understand the ramifications of the success curriculum for Hathaway Scholarship. And Section 4 is money appropriated to the superintendent in conjunction with the Department of Workforce Services on the Work Keys Job Skills Assessment. As you go through the bill very briefly, you'll notice that in Section 1, we appropriate the $100,000 that goes to the superintendent to deal with the sign language as a second language for Hathaway. That goes over into page 2, as the sign language is a fulfillment of the foreign language requirements under Hathaway Student Scholarship. Paragraph little I is a partnership for secondary course curriculum development. 2 little I comes in and develops assessment standards, proficiency standards for the sign language requirements. Section 3 little I, access to transfer students in, so that if you have students that are transferring in that they want to take this, they can. And going over in the top of page, the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3, they report back to the Joint Education Interim Committee on or before October 1st, 2009. Section 2 comes in and appropriates $157,000 to the Department of Education to establish a transcript data center for Common Core coding. This appropriation ends on June 30, 2010. They also report back to the Joint Education Committee no later than October 1st. Section 3 is a $100,000 program that comes in into the 8th grade instruction for post-secondary work so that the 8th graders understand what they're getting into with the Hathaway Scholarship Program. That we split that two ways. At the bottom of page 4, we split it in the tune of $50,000 for proficiency for development counseling. And the top of page 5, the other $50,000 goes into student career assessments. They also report back to Joint Education by October 1st of 2009. Section 4 deals with the Work Keys Job Skills Assessment for Wyoming High School students so that every school in the state through workforce development can have a career readiness certificate available for those students that are pursuing this. This appropriation also ends June 30th of 2010. And going over to page 6, the state superintendent there in paragraph B, in cooperation with Department of Workforce Services, will provide notice to school districts of the expanded assessment opportunity provided here. On or before October 1st of 2009, the state superintendent and the Department of Workforce Services shall report to the JEC. That's pretty much the bill. I'd try to answer any questions. And with that, there is a standing committee amendment, and I would move that amendment at this time on behalf of the appropriations chair, who's not here. Ed goes in and says that all the appropriations contained in all these sections shall be one-time funding and shall not be in the 2011-2012 biennium standard budget request. I move for the adoption of the amendment.
Before we do that, let's go ahead and read in the amendment. Thank you. Senator Coe.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, it says that all appropriations contained in this act shall be considered one-time funding, shall not be contained in any of the agency's 2011-2012 standard budget requests, and then it renumbers, deleting 5 and inserting 6.
Okay, we're on Standing Committee Amendment 1. Questions on Standing Committee Amendment 1? Are we ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 47, say aye. All those opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're back on the bill. Are we ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that the Committee of the Whole rises to report. Oh, excuse me. Thank you, Senator Sessions.
I apologize for bothering the body, but on page 5, where it says, and maybe I don't understand this, at the top of the page, and developing curriculum necessary for success in post-secondary education programs and meeting standardized test requirements. Is the standardized test, is that the ACT or is it the Work Keys test? I don't know what standardized test they mean by that for scholarships available, or is it, we don't use the PAWS for scholarships, so I just would like to know what standardized test that is.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this would be the ACT. The Work Keys is a separate section. Remembering also that in the Hathaway Scholarship Program, we have 4 different levels of scholarship available based on GPA and ACT. So this would be the ACT testing.
Further discussion or ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 47, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 47 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Hastert.
Privilege of the floor.
Yes, you may have. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Members of the Senate, today is Nursing Day, and we've had up in the gallery and here sitting down here is we have instructors and nursing students that braved the weather and came to Cheyenne for the nursing meetings that they're holding today, and they're having a reception tonight. So from Western Wyoming Community College, the nursing students and their instructors, if you please welcome them to the Senate. Please stand up.
Next file for our consideration is Senate File 75. Will the reading clerk please read in the bill?
Senate File Number 75, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, Economic Development Account, an act relating to economic development. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business and Economic Development. The report's back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Thank you. Further reading of the bill. Senator, what is your pleasure? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with the do pass recommendation on Senate File 75 and that further reading of the bill be dispensed with. And, Mr. Chairman, there is also a standing committee amendment, and I would move, well, I guess you got to read that.
Yes, let's read in Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, please.
Senate File 75, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 10.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move also Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and to explain this bill, I'll call on Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, Senate File 75 was brought to your Minerals Committee by the Wyoming Business Council. It's the funding component of the Challenge Loan Program. And I passed out some information on the Challenge Loan Program. It's a program that's been around for quite a few years, and it's had quite a bit of success. I think the important thing for you, for the body to realize, is that it's a revolving loan. And the money that goes into this program stays in this program in the sense that when the loans are paid off, the principal and interest, they go back into the program, and then it feeds on itself, and it goes ahead and it's able to put out more loans. The neat thing about it, it's really a partnership with banks. I think that as we move forward, it's been working well in that area, and also that there's a 15% equity requirement, which you have to understand that these challenge loans, that the state in its position, the Wyoming Business Council, is the same position as the bank in terms of having the proper collateral and those kinds of things within the loan. The purpose of this bill is to deal with the funding, and originally when they brought it to the Minerals Committee, they asked for $18 million. The reason behind that, that's what the Wyoming Business Council thought it would take to fully fund this so it'd be able to live within itself based on the demand. Recognizing the current status of our revenues for the state, the Minerals Committee asked them for what would be considered a bare-bones budget for them to be able to survive through the year 2011. And they came back and said $6 million, and that's the purpose of the Minerals Committee amendment, and I would ask that we vote on that amendment and call for the question.
Discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that we adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 75, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We're back on the bill. We do have another Standing Committee Amendment. Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, in the absence of the Appropriations Committee, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. Well, ask it be read in.
Let's read in Standing Commitment Number 2, please.
Senate File 75, Second Standing Committee Amendment Number 2. Delete the first Senate Standing Committee Amendment.
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, reluctantly, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 and call again on Senator Bebout.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, reluctantly, I would oppose the standing, the amendment from the corporation or the Appropriations Committee. I think the key for this body to understand, and it's really a policy decision that you have to make, is here's a program that's working. It's creating jobs for Wyoming. And as we look to the future, what's happening not only in our state, we're feeling the effects of a nationwide recession. That probably means there will be more demand for this type of program. The thing that I really liked about it is if you look at the loan losses, and in that handout, they have a loan loss reserve of $165,000 on approximately $13 million worth of loans. That's a 0.95%, and that's a loan loss reserve. That doesn't mean we've lost that. Now, there are two loans out there, one in Fremont County and one, I believe, in Goshen County that are having some difficulty, and we represent to the body in this report the loan loss that we think may occur there, and it's about $141,000. Understand, of course, in all these loans that are out there, we're secured, there's personal guarantees, a lot of them are backed up by the SBA because they go through the government loan lending program as well. The reason I would ask you to defeat the Appropriations Committee amendment is because I believe if we put $6 million into this one-time funds, that will fully fund it through the year 2011, and it's a program that works, and I think it's right now is the time to do it. The other thing, too, Mr. Chairman, is this requires a two-thirds vote for final passage of this body and the other body.
Thank you. Discussion. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a little bit of explanation is necessary of why this requires a two-thirds vote. The origination of this program and the funding for it came out of the old Amendment 4 program, which, as far as I personally am concerned, was a disaster. But the creation of this program had its genesis in that. That's a constitutional issue. And so to refund this program with the appropriation, it does not the operating bill, and you heard about that earlier, but to refund this program does require a two-thirds vote. And so that's what it is. We're working on some method in the future to try to clean that up, get that out of the connection with the Amendment 4, because, frankly, it has very little to do with the old failed, I think, failed Amendment 4 program. But we can't do that at this time, and so at this particular time it does require a two-thirds vote to go on with funding. I, too, would ask that you defeat the Appropriation Committee amendment for maybe a little different reason. We're going through bad economic times. There isn't any doubt about that. Income is going to be limited. But there's an old axiom. You don't pull your advertising. You don't try to stop your economic development in bad times. In good times, maybe you can because everything's flowing and it's all right. But if we ever needed this program, I believe that now is the time. And so I would ask you to defeat the second standing committee amendment and to support the bill. It will require a two-thirds vote on passage to fund and continue this program.
Go to Senator Burns.
And Mr. Chairman, just so we're clear, and I'm clear in my mind, this reference to the two-thirds being required, that's speaking on the bill, not the amendment, correct? So whether it's $2 million or $6 million, we still need the two-thirds majority in order to pass?
Senator Burns, I believe that's correct. Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, point of order, I think probably two-thirds is only required on the final bill on the third reading. That's the way it's very similar to a constitutional amendment that we pass. It can squeak by in committee of the whole by one vote, but on the final vote, it'll take two-thirds. And that has nothing to do with the amendment, although the amendment is a fabulously good amendment. And the reason we have the two-thirds is because it's what makes this bill constitutional, this program, because it does fit in the place in the Constitution where our citizens authorized a loan program. At that time, it was called Amendment 4. It was a total disaster, and the government probably... And elsewhere in our Constitution, it talks about not funding, extending the credit of the people of Wyoming to entities not under the control of Wyoming or charities or anything. So I think that's the best advice there is. We'll look forward to that two-thirds vote.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure I didn't make it clear. The good senator from Landers absolutely, and from Sheridan is absolutely right. The two-thirds comes on the final. It does not apply to the amendment. either of the amendments, and it only applies to the final passage of the bill. It can have whatever now, but it will require that. But I wanted everybody to be aware, as we're going into it, that on final passage, it will require a two-thirds vote.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to urge the body to vote aye on this amendment. And the reason being is that we really don't know what the testimony was in the Appropriations Committee or what the rationale behind that was. But in their prudence, they took it down to $2 million. I suggest that we pass this amendment now, and then if need be, have a second reading amendment to strip it off, but at least we'll have that debate. But at this point in time, I think it would be imprudent to defeat it without allowing the Appropriations Committee to have a chance to defend their amendment.
Thanks, Senator Ross. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I would join in that appeal and add one other thing to think about. With the two-thirds requirement on final passage, with the shortage of money that there is, this bill is going to jeopardize a number of other potentially good uses of funds if it passes with the larger appropriation in it. And I think you might get in trouble on third reading with that two-thirds requirement. So for both those, the reason that was mentioned earlier and that reason, I think it might be a good idea at this point to adopt the Appropriations Committee amendment.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, I'm a little bit confused, and I'm looking at this handout that we got that's signed by my colleague from over in Fremont County. At one bullet point, it says there's $3 million available, and then down below, it says total available to lend through 2010 is $5.1 million. Does anybody know actually what's left in this account? The second part of the question is, some of these loans, as I read them, you don't really know when they're coming due or when they're going to default. And so you don't, if this is a revolving loan, I need to know what's coming back into it on the time period we're talking about. And the other thing, it appears we've had some charge-offs on this. Of course, this program's famous for charge-offs. These are really looking pretty good, actually. Last time I remember when we charged off, it was in the $10 million range. And I think it's great because they've got these both down to a couple hundred thousand. So I would say their banking skills are getting better. But if you could tell me kind of where we're at and what's going to roll back into this program from loan repayment so I can get a real figure of what's available.
And I would remind the body that we're on, still on the amendment, still on Standing Committee Amendment 2. Senator Bebout. Oh, Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I am speaking to the amendment. Theoretically, we'll satisfy the need of the program within reason and within the priorities of the budget. If there's $5 million available, that's probably plenty to keep everybody busy for the next couple.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an attempt to answer the questions from my colleague from KC, as of 1/1/09, there was $2.7 million available to lend. That's money that's in the program that's available. Now, last year during the budget session, we added an additional $1 million that will be in the second part of our biennium. Then you add in the $1.4 million. That's a principal and interest that is being returned to the program on the performing loans. That comes up to the $5.15 million that's available to as of 6/30/10 to be loaned. The projections and the demand they see is where we come to the amount of money that we need. If you look at the projections just to the right of there, 09 projections, 2.2, 2000 or 2010, 4.2 million. And then we've added the Main Street loan projections that's now in this program, and it comes up with their amount of money that they figure they need, $7 million. And that's through 6/30/10. and we're only at five, and we wanted to carry the program through the year 2011. So if you're, you know, you could argue that we only need to do it through the next biennium, and if that's the argument that this body believes in, then $6 million is more than we need. If you believe that we should fund it appropriately and move into the year 2011, then the $6 million amount is the amount of funding that would be required.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, to the amendment, and basically the reason being that we're discussing $2 million versus putting $6 million in there, and I was looking at the handout myself, and, you know, rather than just default on the loan, of course, one of the recipients from Sheridan County has to go and get convicted for fraud. Can't just default. But the question I have is, we may be going into hard times, and we don't know how hard these times are going to be and where the state we will be looking for different coffee cans for different amounts of money, basically, to keep the state and to keep our obligations that we have to keep, such as education per the state Supreme Court, or a number of our federal obligations, such as Medicare, which seem to be increases of which never seem to end. And with the recession of the rest of the country, there will be more. So my question becomes, if this requires two-thirds vote to put more money in, therefore it's a constitutional trust, do we need two-thirds of the legislature to take any money back out? Should the state in the next few years really need that money, as opposed to a number of statutory trusts that we have, which a simple majority of the legislature could pull the money back out of?
Senator Burns, I don't see any of our constitutional scholars willing to take that one on. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, well, my colleague from Fremont County is looking up the Constitution. I do know that when Amendment 4 passed, it allowed up to 1% of our assessed valuation to be utilized for the Amendment 4 loan program, and it required two-thirds of vote. I don't think the Constitution technically said that we need two-thirds vote for the appropriation, but we've always felt that's the way to do it, because it took two-thirds vote to do it, and we figured that that was the way the legislature should respond. So I would say the two-thirds vote to put it in, you know, you could even get by without doing it. We've never done that. We shouldn't do that. But to take it out, it probably wouldn't. But I could be very wrong on that one.
Thanks, Senator Bebout. Senator Case.
Senator Mr. Chairman, I think I've got it. Section 12, Economic Development Loan Fund. Notwithstanding Article 3, Section 36, and Article 16, Sections 1 and 2, and 6 of this Constitution, the legislature, by a two-thirds vote of all the members of each of the two houses voting separately, may appropriate monies in an amount not exceeding 1% times the assessed value of the taxable property in the state as shown by the last preceding general assessment for taxation, to promote a revolving investment fund to be used to promote and aid the economic development of the state. So I think two-thirds vote is clearly required for the appropriation. You know, there's just no other way to get around that. There are two more small sections. It says that the investment fund created by this section shall be used to provide fully funded loan guarantees or loans to proposed or existing enterprises which will employ people within the state, providing services within the state, use resources within the state, or otherwise add economic value to goods, services, or resources within the state. And finally, C's only one sentence. Monies within the revolving investment fund shall be loaned or used to guarantee loans under such terms and conditions as the legislature may by law direct. So apparently the terms and conditions we can do, there's no reference to two-thirds vote on the terms and conditions, but there is clearly a reference to the appropriation.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and further on the question is, can we de-appropriate it with a simple majority vote? There's a provision, the next subsection D provides a limitation on it can't go over 1% of the assessed taxable valuation. The assessed valuation comes down, theoretically you might have to de-appropriate it. And it's silent on that. And I would read that in conjunction with the requirement that there be a two-thirds for the appropriation as meaning that we could de-appropriate money with a simple majority.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, not being a constitutional expert, I don't know whether it takes that to deappropriate it. I would suspect it does. The reading of the Constitution is why we separated the appropriation from the rules and regulations, which do not take a two-thirds vote. And that's what we did previously. On the appropriation, it very clearly does, and our legal counsel from LSO and others and the department and everything clearly reminded us that any appropriation going into here will take the two-thirds because of the genesis from Amendment 4. And so our understanding is that, once again, that's on third reading. And vote the amendment up or down, that's your pleasure. I think it has proven to be a good program. The default rate that was mentioned earlier is pretty small for that much money in the banking and loaning world. Most of those, I may add, were agriculture. Some of them related to the default of the seed lab area up in Goshen County. There's one, I think, also in Fremont County. But they've been pretty prudent and, I think, done a good job in economic development for the state of Wyoming.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Larson's reluctant motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to Senate File 75, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
That motion has passed. Division being called for. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, please rise. Those opposed, please rise.
Well.
The chair votes aye. That amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Further discussion. Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 75, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 75 has passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 84. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File Number 84, sponsored by Senator Hastert. Aggravated Assault Choking, an act relating to crimes and offenses. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise a report, it do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 84. There is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask to be read in at this time.
Please read the amendment.
Senate File 84, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 1.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, which in essence is now the bill, and yield to the good senator from Sweetwater County for an explanation of the amendment and the bill.
Thank you. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, bring you Senate File 84 and ask for your favorable consideration. And as the good chairman of Judiciary pointed out, that in essence the amendment is the main thrust of the bill right now. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate, the amendment deals with a collaborative work between the prosecutors, the DAs, coalitions, and defense attorneys to come up with some language that everybody can, I guess you'd say, live with. This is going to give prosecutors an additional tool to help prosecute strangulation and choking in situations, Mr. Chairman. It will now allow felony charges to be brought to individual that strangles their victim. The problem's been that because there's really most of the time no physical sign of injury, it can be very difficult under current law to prove assault charges in cases involving prosecution, Mr. Chairman. We've had a couple of Supreme Court rulings that have brought this to light, Mr. Chairman, and the reason for the bill and the reason for the amendment. The amendment, Mr. Chairman, brings it into the language that's in statutes today of serious bodily injury. There's definitions in the statutes right now, Mr. Chairman, and of serious bodily injury and in the jury instructions. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the amendment and ask for your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Senator Hassett. We're on the amendment discussion. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 84, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. That Standing Committee Amendment has passed. We are back on the bill. Are we ready for the question? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, reluctantly, but seeing nobody else wants to take this one on, let me ask a question or two about it as it now stands with the Standing Committee Amendment. What we're doing is we're adding or attempts to cause. Right now, the crime is it causes serious bodily injury. We're adding an attempt to it. And my question is twofold. One, how are people charged who attempt to cause seriously bodily injury but don't get the job done, don't actually do it, because they're charged somewhere else? And the nature of my concern that prompts that question is frequently prosecutors will charge as serious a crime as they can possibly think of, possibly justify, in order to get a plea bargain to a lesser crime. And you're essentially depriving people of their right to a day in court, because if the crime that's charged is serious enough, people are reluctant to take a chance with what might happen in a trial, reluctant to go to the expense that they would have to defend themselves in trial. And that system can lead to a circumstance where people are essentially denied their day in court, and people who really aren't guilty of anything wind up pleading to some lesser charge to avoid running the risks. And so I'd like to know, what are we really doing when we add the attempt here to the current statute that says it's causing?
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an attempt to try to answer that question with regards to attempt, apparently there's, and I haven't read the case, but it was cited to us in the committee that recently, within the last few weeks, a decision has come down called Schaefer versus State of Wyoming, in which in a domestic violence situation, the court ruled that you can't really attempt to attempt. What was going on is because of the nature of these strangulation kind of domestic abuse cases, what would happen would be that the aggressor would choke them to the point where they may actually lose consciousness and then let go, or not leave any real demonstrable evidence of any injuries. And so what was happening was that When you look at paragraph A, in this is all in the aggravated assault statutes, they weren't able to show a serious bodily injury. So then they said to try it under that they attempted to do that, and the court said the statute doesn't provide for that, nor can you have an actual attempt to do that, an attempt of an attempt. By way of compromise, we added in, pursuant to the prosecutor's request, that in paragraph A, you can cause bodily injury or attempt to cause bodily injury. Now, for the most part, in almost any crime, we do sentence and we do charge people with attempt, attempted murder, whatever it might be, as if it was the crime in and of itself. The biggest problem here is that for in domestic violence kinds of situations, a lot of times they weren't able to have the proof that this individual actually attempted some serious bodily injury. Now, the testimony of those women that were in the committee as to what it did to them, thinking they were going to die several different times and so forth, was really moving. And the committee felt that we needed to do something, but that the bill as it was written really didn't solve the problem. So we added in the attempt to cause in paragraph A, and then we defined, we stripped out most of the bill, and then paragraph 5 on page 2, line 10, goes back to say intentionally or attempts to cause serious bodily injury by impeding the normal breathing or circulation of blood of another. And we stripped out the business about the police officers because really didn't need that. And my discussions with the Highway Patrol today confirm that they're good with that as it stands now. So that's basically how we got the bill to where it is now. You know, the question is, can they charge him with a more serious crime? It is possible, but it's really a function of the evidence that they may have. And when dealing with these situations, ultimately the fallback position, and it's not like aggravated assault and battery is not a lesser included offense in an attempted murder or something like that. So the use of the aggravated assault statutes and a felony for these kinds of actions were the preferable statute of choice for the prosecutors in terms of charging these crimes. So hopefully that answers your question. I'm not going to tell you it's not completely black and white, because you still have, you know, by bringing in the attempt language, it's still going to be a matter of proof. But certainly the prosecutors felt that this gave them a chance to charge a felony rather than a misdemeanor for simple battery or for touching, inappropriate touching.
Thanks, Senator Scott.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, well, I can see how this statute would fix the particular circumstance with the choking. And as you say, it's a matter of proof. You still got to prove it. What I'm looking for here is, as I understand, this is the general aggravated assault statute, is it not? And what else are we doing? What are we transforming from simple assault and battery with this attempt language into a felony? And are we going to see a lot more convictions or guilty pleas for simple assault and battery because the prosecutors charge, not outside the domestic violence situation, charge this felony and say it was an attempt to cause serious bodily harm? And, you know, I don't hold with bar fighting as a form of sport, but I'm afraid some of my constituents do. And are we going to turn a whole bunch of them into felons with this? What are the consequences beyond the specific problem that we're trying to solve? And I certainly don't want to jeopardize this bill in committee of the whole. But I wonder if maybe by third reading we don't need to think pretty hard about what we're doing generally and not just in the specific evil that this bill is brought to address.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, and that's a very valid point, and perhaps the fix is whether or not you wish to have the attempts to cause language in paragraph A and just leave Romanet 5 as it is, so that you have the attempt as only specific to the impeding of normal breathing, circulation of blood of another by applying pressure to the throat or neck and blocking the nose or mouth. Perhaps that's specific only to that event, and you may not actually need the amendment to paragraph A. This, as I said, came to us as a compromise from the prosecutors and everybody else. But thinking it through, you could actually delete the language for paragraph A and still keep Romanet 5 to deal with the situation which we're talking about, which is the strangulation kinds of situations in domestic violence.
Thank you, Senator Hester.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as the good Senator Appropriations or Judiciary Chairman has brought up, that this has been worked on extensively with prosecutors, district attorneys, and defense attorneys, keeping in mind the issues and trying to charge in these cases. The problem has been that, you know, because hasn't been physical signs of injury, that it's been very difficult. You know, and I can remind just a little bit about strangulation here. You know, it's a cruel crime. It's one that is used as it's kind of a terroristic sort of measure where they terrorize their victim by choking them almost to death and then letting them go. You know, it's with this legislation, we give the prosecution an additional tool. It still has to be proven. They still have to make their case, and it still is up to the jury to do that. And it's hopeful, Mr. Chairman, with the rise of domestic violence this would help reduce the number of strangulations in the case. You know, just a little bit about strangulations. It just takes over 30 pounds of pressure to close a trachea, but only 11 pounds of pressure to occlude a carotid artery. And when they're occluded, unresponsiveness can occur within 10 seconds, Mr. Chairman, and it's also reported that for every 10 seconds of occlusion, the victim will remain unresponsive for an additional 10 seconds. And then for every minute of complete occlusion, the victim is frequently unresponsive, apneic, and will not recover without medical intervention. Strangulation is very serious, and it causes apnea in excess of 4 to 6 minutes, will result in brain damage or death. Mr. Chairman, it was also handed to me on Friday, a second Supreme Court ruling that just came out. It just came out Friday afternoon, and it has also been a case that was tried, and they were attempting to get aggravated assault on strangulation. We're successful at all the lower levels, but the Supreme Court ruled that because the laws in the state don't require or don't have strangulation as aggravated assault, that they overturned that ruling. And I'm just going to, if I may, Mr. Chairman, paraphrase from that Supreme Court ruling here just a little bit. And as we hasten to add that, and without using the name, the perpetrator conduct was despicable, reprehensible, and brutal. But what the law has recognized as battery and what has recognized as aggravated assault is separated by a considerable chasm which the legislature may want to address. And that was out of the Supreme Court ruling that just came out Friday, Mr. Chairman. You look at strangulation, the choking, it's a very serious crime. It happens all the time. And we need it. The prosecutors need the additional tools to be able to prosecute these cases, Mr. Chairman. And the fact is that this language was a huge compromise, and it's as the good chairman noted, it still has to be proven in these cases. So, and it still is left up to the jury in these cases, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Hastert. For the discussion, are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that we adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 84, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Further discussion on the bill? Having had the question called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the committee whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 84, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Senate File 84 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise for the purpose of a 10-minute break and sit again.
Having heard the motion, all those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Chairs in doubt, division, have no.
Could be scary, could it?
This is a traffic jam.
It is now. All right. Our next bill for our consideration is Senate File 62. Yeah, we do. They're on the floor. They're just not paying attention. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate Files Number 62, sponsored by Senator Ross. Discretionary Clause Prohibition Act, an act relating to insurance.
Oh. Gentlemen, we need a quorum. We need a couple of you to come back on the floor. There we go. We're good. Don't forget to count me. Okay, we're good.
It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senator Carrier, Perkins, Ross, Sessions, and Burns, Senator Ross, Chairman.
Thank you. Having heard the reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise the report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 62, Discretionary Clause Prohibition Act. There is a standing committee amendment, which I'd ask be read in at this time.
Please read the amendment.
Senate File 62, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 3, lines 1 through 5.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and in discussing Standing Committee Number 1, I will also make reference and move later, but Committee of the Whole Amendments 1 and 2. They're all interrelated. Senate File 62 is a bill that prohibits in our law, or will prohibit in our law, discretionary clauses in health insurance contracts. Now, what does that mean? For our insurance contracts in this state, health insurance contracts, a discretionary clause is what it basically says it is. It gives the insurer the right to have unfettered discretion as to whether or not a claim for medical coverage is compensable or not. It is a fallback position for the insurers that purports to give that carrier sole discretion and authority to determine eligibility for benefits and to interpret the terms and of the provisions of the policy or contract as it sees. Now, health insurance contracts, when we purchase those, we expect that there will be certain benefits that we pay in premiums, and we expect those benefits to be paid. However, with a discretionary clause, those payments become contingent upon the discretion of the insurer. There are a number of states that have authorized or have passed, most generally by rule and regulation through their insurance commissioner's office, prohibitions against discretionary clauses in health insurance contracts. Unfortunately, our insurance commissioner does not have that ability, and so it then comes back and falls upon us to consider whether or not we wish to make it a law that discretionary contracts and health insurance contracts are prohibited. The bill that you have before you is a NAIC Model Act, which is the acronym stands for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And this is their Model Act, and it basically, I just took it directly from NAIC. Purpose, of course, is a purpose and intent clause in here, and normally we don't include those, but I thought it was important in this particular case, and so did the committee, to allow our constituents to know in law that they're entitled to know and to have protection with regard to their benefits in their contracts. What the Standing Committee Amendment does is it takes out on page 3 disability insurance and under Romanet I, or 2I on page 2, and then there's a typo on line 18 where it says cooperation. It should say corporation. And as we move along, as I discuss this, Committee of the Whole Amendments number 1 and number 2, there was my failure to extract the disability references in other parts of the bill so that this only pertains to health insurance. So with that, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you. Discussion on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. The question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 be read in.
Please read the amendment.
Senate File 62, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1, page 2, line 15.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. This goes in and strikes the balance of the line on page 15 after the word health carrier and all of the line on 16 so that we've taken out disability insurance. The purpose of this is I'm trying to keep this focus simply on health insurance. So with that, if there's no questions, I'd call for the question on that amendment also.
Discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion with respect to Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to Senate File 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 be read in at this time.
Please read.
Senate File 62, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2, page 1, line 4.
Thank you. Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2. Ladies and gentlemen, this amendment goes into page 4, and you'll see a paragraph B. That's disability insurance. I apologize for not catching that earlier, but this would remove disability insurance from 26.13.304, which is discretionary clause prohibited. Call for the question on that amendment.
Discussion on Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2. Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment number 2 to Senate File 62, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Mr. Chairman, so we're back on the bill, and I stand for questions on the bill. I'd urge you to consider this situation. I want to read you a quote, if I can find it, from the Attorney General's office in the state of California. It says as follows. Discretionary clause makes those payments contingent on the unfettered discretion of the insurer, thereby nullifying the promise to pay and rendering the contract potentially illusory. Now, in most contractual situations in the law, you have a body of law that says that when there is unequal bargaining power between the parties that are contracting, that the contract will be construed against the maker of the contract, which is generally the one who has most power. In this situation, with the discretionary clause in there, it is impossible for the courts to do anything but uphold the discretion of the insurer. In this situation, I think that all we're trying to do, we're not saying what benefits are going to be paid, we're not saying what's going to be done, or we're not necessarily including anything in there about you need to pay this for this and this for that, or we're attempting to raise premiums or anything. We're just simply saying let's have a level playing field, let's ban these discretionary clauses, parties know what their benefits are, And if there is a review, we know then that the court can use its normal review process to construe the contract. And that's what the purpose of this bill is.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Now, just for the record, the Standing Committee Amendment Number, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 has passed. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. And, of course, in Wyoming, insurance is very difficult to get, particularly for small businesses. And if you're able to get it, it's expensive. Will this have any effect on the number of carriers because of our limited market that they may pull out of Wyoming? I'm not sure what other states around us are doing. Are we going to put a real tough create a tough situation for small employees that are trying, employers that are trying to have insurance for their employees?
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In an attempt to answer that, we have to walk a fine line in the state of Wyoming. I mean, we have a limited number of insurers, and you don't want to make it so impossible that, or the requirements so stringent that they can't do business. We only have a handful of insurers actually in the state, and we need to be careful about that. But I will also tell you that none of the insurers in committee testified that if you pass this bill, we're going to leave the state of Wyoming, or that you're going to make it so impossible for us to continue to do business. What it probably will mean is that they probably will have to rewrite their insurance contracts to specify what the benefits are more plainly. There was some testimony in committee that perhaps this language or the banning of the discretionary clause would prevent the insurer from being benevolent. And I suggest to you that I question that. There is nothing in the law or in this bill that ever prevents an insurance company from being benevolent. So I'd urge your favorable consideration of this.
And we'll go to Senator Larson and then Senator Scott. Thank
you, Chairman. I have never heard the two words benevolent and insurance company used in the same sentence. But was there any discussion of what effect it may or may not have on rates?
Thank you. Senator Scott Ross.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
If it please the court. Good question. And, you know, there was some mention that this could cause insurance rates to go up or that to increase their expenses. To be quite frank with you, the debate in the committee on this bill was, by the insurers, was don't pass this bill, pass the next bill, which is a bill that will be coming up at a later time, which is medical necessity and external review. It is possible that it could increase rates, but I find that hard to believe. I think it's just going to make their job a little bit more difficult in that they're going to have to be a little bit more explicit with their definitions of their benefits as they move forward in their contracts. But I don't expect that it's going to increase their rates.
Thank you.
That's my own opinion, though.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of comments. First, I have heard the words insurance and benevolent used in the same sentence, but most generally there's a not somewhere between. Mr. Chairman, a little more serious note. We do have a limited number of health insurers in this state, but frankly, we're better endowed than many other states that have gone overboard on the regulation and have even less than we do. It's surprising the number of states where there's really only one that is actively competing in most of the market. Mr. Chairman, I do have some questions about this bill. Frankly, having an intent clause in there makes me nervous that we're trying to do something maybe we shouldn't ought to. We generally see intent clauses where there's something a little doubtful about the legality of what we're doing, although I haven't found that here. I do wonder what the volume what's the financial impact of this bill? What is the volume that where the clause is making a discretionary clause is making a difference currently? Do we have any information on that? And second, I wonder a little bit what unintended consequences are we going to see here as they get more precise in defining what's covered and what's not. Are we going to see a tendency to explicitly not cover things in the contract and then to turn around and say, no, that's explicitly not covered and we can't give it to you? Are there some unintended consequences possible here? My instinct, frankly, is to say, look, the contract ought to be a contract and you shouldn't have unfettered discretion to turn it down, which is the purpose of this bill. But what are the going to be the full range of the consequences here? What do we know about that?
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do not know, or could I profess that I know what the consequences may be or not. In terms of empirical data, in terms of how often this is out there or has been used or whatnot, what we heard was the stories of individuals packing the committee room talking about their lack of recourse. For whatever reason, they have, we heard stories from, about Remicade as a particular pharmaceutical drug that was denied, even though they had a history of showing that it worked with this patient, but then they decided to cut it off. They went, tried to get help, went to the insurance commissioner, whatever else, and ultimately they were left with nothing. They were left with nothing other than the insurance contract says they have unfettered discretion. Is there a possibility of unintended consequences? I imagine there are. But what they are, I do not know, nor was any evidence presented in the committee that if you do this, if you do X, Y is going to occur. What they said was it's possible that it could cause rates to go up. They didn't really adamantly. It wasn't quite like in the old days when we were doing, for instance, breast cancer screening, and the insurers came in and said, this is going to definitely raise your rates and all of that stuff. That wasn't the kind of testimony that we heard in judiciary. Can I fully say what are there other unintended consequences? It is possible. Anything is possible. The question, though, is ultimately, what is the best solution? We have no other real remedy because our insurance commissioner, to be quite frank with you, is fairly neutered and doesn't have quite the power that insurance commissioners in other states have. Do we go overboard in regulation? I don't think we do. And part of the reason why I've tried to pare this bill down is to avoid that appearance by getting into the whole area of disability insurance policies. I want this specific only to health insurance policies and to give, our average citizen the opportunity to have some sort of say, and when we get into further legislation, to be able to have these things reviewed and a determination made, and whatever that determination may be, so be it, but at least we'll have some a more level playing field.
Thank you, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me try to get at where I'm trying to go a slightly different way. We're not the first state to do something like this. My understanding is a number of other states have adopted this. Do you know, or was there any testimony in committee as to what the practical effect of eliminating discretionary clauses was in those other states?
Senator Ross.
I do not know, nor did we have any presentation of, if you do this, this is what happened in California. Or if you do this, this is what happened in Montana. Now, in Montana, that was done by their insurance commissioner up there, and it's been upheld recently by the United States District Court as being a valid regulatory order of the insurance commissioner. But we haven't heard what the effect of that is. We didn't hear any of that, so I can't really say.
Further discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 62, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 62 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 113. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 113, sponsored by Senator Meyer, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool, and Act relating to the Wyoming Health Insurance Pool. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Thank you. Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 113 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and normally I would yield to the sponsor to explain the bill, but he's tied up in appropriations, and I'm a co-sponsor, and he asked me to take care of it. So, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it tells the Wyoming Uninsurable Pool, which is the pool for the people who cannot obtain at any reasonable cost health insurance, to have a catastrophic health plan with a deductible level of $25,000. So very high deductible. And then it puts a limitation that this will be available only up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which is quite high. We had a discussion of what that was in committee. My memory is it's over income over $60,000 a year, goes up as high as $80,000 in some of the family sizes. So it's a very high income. It's, Mr. Chairman, we think this would be a valuable addition to the policies that the uninsurable pool offers, because it will be a less costly policy because you're of the size of the deductible. You're cutting out somewhere in the vicinity of half the claims expense when you go to a deductible that's that high. We had the uninsurable pool was represented in the committee by the insurance commissioner and by the administrator of the uninsurable pool, and they don't know for sure what this will do to their claims experience. They said typically in the private insurance market, only the people that are good risks go for a policy with this high a deductible. But since this is an uninsurable pool, these are people with higher risks than average, and they were a little concerned they might get some adverse selection. And for that reason, the committee, the limitation in terms of the federal poverty level is not needed for compliance with Article 16, Section 6 of our Constitution. That's handled other ways in this program already, but it does provide some limitation on the number of people that will come apply for this. And we discussed it and decided to leave it in because it does mean we'll get into this a little slowly and get some experience before we get too much exposure. We think most of the people in the lower income levels will go for one of the either 1,000 or 5,000 deductible plans that are already available, and there'll be a relatively limited number that will come for this high deductible. And we think it will be important in terms of people having the kind of insurance available that will help them keep from losing their homes, losing all their assets, in a bankruptcy, and we think it will be helpful to our hospitals in terms of getting some of the extremely high-cost patients better paid for, which will, of course, help all the rest of us in terms of our insurance. So, but they did say they weren't sure how many more customers this bill would come in and what their experience would be, because they think instead of getting the lowest risk of customer, they will get a little higher risk because of the nature of this being an uninsurable pool. Mr. Chairman, if that's the bill, it's a simple bill, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the sponsor, and granted, this is new territory, but was there any indication of how these people that are considered low income could come up with even deductibles of $1,000 or $5,000? Maybe a little reflection on that 400% figure as well, if you could, too, on line 2, page 2. Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in the existing uninsurable plan, frankly, there has been a difficulty. The really low-income people can't afford to get into this. We do have slightly lower rates for those under 250% of the federal poverty, and those are eligible to be general fund subsidized. The ones that are over that, it's still a problem affording it, but basically they're higher-risk people, and they really need the health insurance. So they find a way because it's better than the alternative. It's a problem. And we think it'll be a problem for these people. My guess, my personal guess, is that we're really only looking at the people somewhere between 300% and 400% of the federal poverty level. So relatively high income, the sort of income that, say, a more senior teacher would bring home. And now they mostly have health insurance. They wouldn't get into this. But it will provide for some of the small businesses that can't afford insurance or sole proprietors that aren't eligible for the small group. It will provide some insurance, and it will help some other individuals. I don't think we're dealing with a big number, but I think it will provide a very useful degree of protection. I hope that answers the question. And I can't give you a better estimate than I already did on what the 400% poverty is.
Thank you. For the discussion, are you ready for the Senator Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, this may be kind of a follow-on to the question that was maybe asked, but I noticed on the fiscal note there, it's kind of it's rather lean for information there. And I just wondered if maybe the sponsor could enlighten us just a little bit there.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, when we had the uninsurable pool management and the insurance commissioner in committee, they said the reason it was pretty lean was they just don't have any experience with uninsurable pools taking up at this high a deductible and what the take-up will be like, which is one of the reasons the committee left the 400% qualification in place so that we get into it a little slowly and see what our experience really getting before we have too many people come in. It's lean because they simply do not know.
Thank you. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion when the committee whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 113, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 113 has passed committee the whole. Senator Anderson.
I move that the committee the whole rise and report.
Okay. Having heard the motion, all those in favor? Wait a second. Is that right? Am I doing this right? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 68, due pass amended. Senate File 124, due pass. Senate File 125, due pass. Senate File 31, due pass amended. Senate File 47, due pass amended. Senate File 75, due pass amended. Senate File 84, due pass amended. Senate File 62, due pass amended. And Senate File 113, due pass, Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried, and the report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
January the 26th, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 145. Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed, Mr. President. The House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 13, Subdivision Fences 2, ayes 7, noes 50, excused 3. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
January the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 63, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Fladern, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman. January the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 65, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Fladern, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman. January the 26th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to who was referred Senate File 127, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. January the 26th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 115, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources. Tomorrow night upon adjournment up in S-15, we're going to take up Senate File 21, subdivision located within irrigation districts, Senate File 114, Animal Control, Senate File 34, Beginning Agriculture Producer Financial Authority, Senate File 87, Wolf Brucellosis Testing, Senate File 10, Brucellosis Management Program, and Senate File 71, Temporary In-Stream Flow.
Senator Cove.
Yeah, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over here in S-11 to take up Senate File 117, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Act Eligibility, Senate File 130, Child Abuse Penalties, House Bill 62 in Gross, Charter School Law Amendments, and House Bill 90, Wind River Reservation Education Programs.
Senator Von Fladern.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet in 15 minutes in S-13 to take up Senate File 119, Public Transportation Funding, and Senate Joint Resolution 1, Equal Military Benefits for Citizens. And, Mr. President, Senate File 119 may be laid back to Wednesday if the main sponsor is still in appropriations.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Tuesday, January 27th, 30 minutes after noon recess in room S-16 to take up Senate File 126, Hospital Bill Installment Payment Plans, House Bill 667, Engrossed, Tobacco Excise Tax, House Bill 102, Engrossed, Excise Tax, Vendor Compensation, and if time permits, House Bill 101, Engrossed, Excise Tax, Manufacturing Exemption.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll try to top that exciting list. Your Corporations Committee, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, Committee Number 7, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in S-19, Senate File 94, Campaign Finance Reporting, Election Periods, Senate File 26, Voter Registration Deadline, Senate File 102, County Official Salaries, and Senate File 50, Small Group Insurance. Thank you, Mr. President.
You've heard the motion that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Tuesday, January 27th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried and Senate is adjourned.